You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
And welcome to a very special episode of the Anarchaeologist Podcast. Today, we're talking death and mortuary practices in archaeology. Isn't that a wonderful introduction? Today, I'm speaking to Mr. Howard Williams, or Professor Howard Williams. Is that the correct terminology?
Yeah, that's fine.
And we're talking about death and mortuary archaeology. So, can you tell us a little bit about why you're interested in this kind of area of archaeology, and what do you do?
Well, I am Professor of Archaeology at the University of Chester, and one of the areas I'm interested in is burial archaeology, or more broadly, I call it mortuary archaeology. And I've been interested in this since I was an undergraduate student. I can blame a certain little-known character who used to teach at the University of Sheffield for this, now Professor Mike Parker Pearson, name might be familiar to you, and he now is at UCL, but he was a very inspirational lecturer as an undergraduate, and I took his funerary archaeology course, and I remember very much, very, very clearly being introduced by him to, not to death as such, but to and not necessarily for the first time to archaeologists digging graves, but to the wide range of ways in which we can approach that topic. And I remember he set an essay for us as a second year student, I think I was at the time, on how do we approach death pollution from an archaeology perspective, the fears of contagion that surround the grave and the body. And I remember sitting in a very hot seminar room at Sheffield, surrounded by other keen students, while he gorged on his packed lunch and tried to give us guidance on how we answer that question in essays. And I think Mike really was one of the key inspirations for me to not simply reflect occasionally on bits of burial evidence as part of my research, but to focus on this for my undergraduate dissertation, looking at Anglo-Saxon burial, and everything else has spun out from there with my master's at Reading, supervision by Heinrich Herker, who is one of the most inspirational burial archaeologists I've ever come across. And then I went on and did a PhD at Reading on that topic, looking at Anglo-Saxon cremation. And so I've kind of, that set me on the route to be just a bit death-obsessed ever since, really.
It's something that all archaeologists come in contact with. I mean, it's not as if it's very much removed from archaeology. It's very much a part of the past that we look at when it comes to people. But it's interesting that there is a very big distinction that some people don't really like to think about the whole death thing themselves. I mean, how have you found people within archaeology as opposed to maybe people outside archaeology? Do you find they relate to death differently because of archaeology?
I have mixed feelings about mortuary archaeology. I'll answer that in a number of hopefully it'll make sense when I get there, but I have mixed feelings about bracketing off mortuary archaeology, and it's come in ebbs and tides, this whether we should treat mortuary archaeology as a separate sub-discipline. And I also find it comes in flows different responses to how we characterize ourselves as death specialists, as people who deal with the ancient dead, or perhaps the not so ancient dead, in terms of our identities as professionals and students. I mean, I see, for example, in the subject a whole subculture of people who wallow in it. They either wear white coats and call themselves, you know, human osteologists or physical anthropologists, and they like picturing themselves with skulls and tweeting about anything that's vaguely grisly. And then there's those that take a very serious sort of distanced view of their relationship to their subject matter, of their research. So those that wallow it in it are one extreme, and those that perhaps like to make out that perhaps it's just another category of material and it's nothing special might be seen as the opposite of that. So I think we see a lot of variety in terms of how archaeologists deal with this kind of topic. And I think we see that in different styles of writing and different ways of dealing with it. So when it comes back to the point of our professional persona, the other point I would make is that many people are using that as a guise. Many people are using that as a mask, a professional mask, in the same way as they may or may not wear a tie or wear jeans. The way they present their relationship with death is a bit of a lie. Mm-hmm. And we don't really necessarily want to talk about our personal engagements with mortality when we're studying ancient skeletons or ancient tombs or even quite recent cemeteries. So I think we have to create a bit of a natural distance because we're trying to frame out the way we talk mm-hmm. and the way we deal with death in a slightly more sort of neutral terms. Mm-hmm. But I think it has, over the years, for me personally, and I wouldn't say this applies to everyone, has been necessarily abstracted. I don't want to try and understand, get inside the individual mind of the past person or the past society. And I think we do have to be a little bit more honest about that, about how we don't want to necessarily try to empathise too closely with people in past societies, and yet still we are of course bouncing around our own experiences of death. So I don't think I don't think that archaeologists have some kind of special privileged view of death, but I do think it makes us reflect on quite common and patterns in what people do in a slightly different perspective. And I think it does bring something to the interdisciplinary table of how we approach mortuary practices. I think archaeologists have a lot to say. So I don't think we're special because we deal with old skeletons, and I don't think we should perhaps wallow in our link to the dead too much. But I do think we can bring stories and narratives that other subjects can't do to the study of mortality.
Oh, definitely. And I think archaeology, for me, is very much, I've always said, it's a meta subject because it incorporates so many different other kind of viewpoints, whether it be scientific kind of analysis or whether it's something that's more akin to philosophy in the way that we reflexively look at what we do. And actually, this is one of the points that I've always tried to make about us digging it up, is that we're paying it forward. As a society, what we're doing is we're treating the past with respect because in 1,000 years' time, we want our legacy to be preserved in the same way. We want archaeologists of the future to kind of say, actually, you know what, we'll take time and we'll take effort and we'll treat these remains from our present just as nicely. And I think there's this almost kind of sense of not just respect for the dead because they're from the past or the but there's almost like a respect for our own bodies that we want to engender in the way that we treat the bodies of the dead. Am I being crazy here?
We're always reflecting of what we would expect or what we would feel comfortable about, in the future. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how contingent this can be in terms of, what are our expectations of what we would expect to our bodies? And some of us will quite blandly say, "Oh, I don't care. What happens to bits of my body? I'll happily give my organs to help someone else in the future. And likewise, what happens to my bones? If they're of any use to anyone, then so be it." But other people, of course, have a different take on that. Mm-hmm. The only other thing I'd say in response to your point is it's very valid, but of course we say a lot about respect, but as many archaeologists have flagged up, we're very woolly when we talk about respect. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it respectful to find something funny written on a gravestone? And is that respect because we're reading it, we're bothering to read it, mm-hmm. and it's a joke, and we've actually responded to that by laughing? Or is it disrespectful to make the noise of laughter in a cemetery? Mm-hmm. And equally, are we more worried about what people will perceive from our reaction in the same way as you know, being in a quiet computer room or on a bus, laughing out loud at something we've just read on our phones or on our PCs. Is it fun? Is that intervention? And is it, could it be misread by others as laughing at them? So we have the same problem of perspective, even in the context of an excavation, or even in the context of walking in a modern cemetery, between our reaction and what people might make of it. So being respectful can sometimes be just a very lame way of saying we don't want to, we're fearful of doing anything in case it might be misunderstood. And other times, I think we can be very clear. You know, other times it's woolly. Other times we can be very clear about what is not appropriate, what is not on the cards, what we shouldn't be doing in terms of best practice. So I think respect gets bandied around a lot, and often we're not really using it very carefully. And sometimes perhaps we're overusing it.
Yeah. I think I probably throw it around quite a lot because I'm hoping that somebody will actually understand what I mean. But you're very right. Now, I mean, obviously, even being in a graveyard, I mean, like, I saw recently a blog, you take students around to kind of categorize old gravestones. I know. Yes. I've done that as well, where you basically...
Oh, right.
Yeah, I've done that. We've got about four cemeteries within walking distance of my house here in Aberdeen. It's very odd. There's one even in the middle of the city, like right smack bang in the middle. And, well, we went to one of them and we were recording, obviously, the date, the style, and kind of like categorizing them and just having a look at the kind of range of variation and how the styles may have changed, you know, what was written on them.
Yes.
But obviously, you know, it's interesting because I'm sure there are people who would even see taking down that information as disturbing the dead.
Hmm. This is very apposite because my latest blog is an open apology, given a dimension of our recent survey in Chester, where someone has witnessed our activities and has complained to my academic institution, the University of Chester, about our presence there. And I must say that everywhere I have done a survey in a churchyard or a cemetery, there have been people who have not wanted to approach us, but then it's equally been people who have approached us with reservations about what we're doing. And within seconds of explaining why we are there and the limits and restrictions on what we're doing, because as you might appreciate, just using the word archaeologist or archaeology can bring forth all manner of misunderstandings. But as long as we, you know, but very quickly I find that we can, my students usually or myself, can explain what we're doing, what we're not doing, and people may not necessarily be enthusiastic or interested, but they certainly can be assured we're not doing anything disrespectful. But in this particular occasion, the individual did not want to come up to us and talk to us for whatever reason, and they put in a formal complaint. So I've been discussing with my students about what did we do wrong? Did we do anything wrong, or was it just that we were there and making some noise? And so we've been reflecting on that and very seriously. And it is an issue where, if you are visiting a cemetery and you see someone else visiting a cemetery, you may have an opinion on the way they're dressed, their age, their group as a group of people doing something. You may be interested in what they're doing, or you may be disapproving. But if you're there visiting a recent grave yourself, it can be really disturbing and upsetting, perhaps, to see that kind of activity. So again, it depends on your perspective, I think, very much. But I think the more we can talk to people about what we're trying to achieve with our work, be it excavation or field work, the better we can be open and honest, and at least, even if they're not interested, they can understand why we're doing the work.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. I must say that I was born in Germany. And in Germany, the cemeteries are very different. Yes. I've always noticed that cemeteries over here are very wooded and they're very kind of hemmed off. And there's a really lovely cemetery in Dortmund. And I used to be taken round when I was a young child in a pram. And I used to be walked around the cemetery because it was open, it was airy. There was nice, neat rows, and there were people from the council would come and they would maintain the place, you know, so they maintained the walkways, they'd remove like weeds and stuff. And what you could do is they even have facilities where you could take water and water the plants. And many of the gravestones had, you know, flowers from relatives there and had little candles and everything. And it's absolutely, it's really lovely, lovely place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very funny and it's very odd to see the very, very big cultural difference in cemeteries here. Have you ever noticed a difference in cemeteries if you've ever kind of been abroad and seen cemeteries?
Well, I've been doing a lot of field work in Sweden. And in Sweden, you do notice the Church of Sweden retains management of a lot of the cemeteries and churchyards, and the level and the investment of money in the maintenance and the quality of maintenance is exceptionally high. But then even within the UK, I've seen a lot of variation in the way and style of maintenance, and a lot of what we call neatness can be down to a whole complex set of decisions about which memorials you're willing to move to allow your mowers to get in there. So one person's neat, tidy grass is one thing, an area that is less tidy, maybe because it is still has many, you know, in situ memorials. And of course, the other thing is, in many churchyards, you have conservation areas where there is a bid to try and limit the intervention to allow them to go at least partially wild for biodiversity. So yeah, churchyards are not simply for bits of memorial, they're also for wildlife now. And so I think there's lots of balancing going on in that regard. I would also say that, of course, even in the UK, we have some examples where there's new functions to the cemeteries and churchyards and are being sort of promoted. And one I visited a couple of years ago was Gloucester City Council, who have a tea room in their cemetery just up the hill from the crematorium. So you can, amongst the smells of roses and occasional smell of burning bodies, you can the wafting aroma of a fried breakfast, and you can go in for a cup of tea. So it may be that this is about re-socializing with living people spaces that otherwise seen as sort of sacred for only mourners to visit. Yeah. Many historic cemeteries are places people walk through, cycle through, have their lunch. So I think that we see a lot of variety, and even in our society, in what people get up to in cemeteries.
I must say that what's very interesting to me has always been is the kind of the ideas about death that people have. You know, our society very much is almost, I always feel that there's a fear of death. You know, like death is this other thing. It's like this big other that kind of always makes us think about things. You know, like I just feel that like death is only a terrible thing in our society. Whereas in some ways we can look at death in other ways if we were more aware of what happens post-mortem. You know, I feel a lot of people once somebody's dead, they're in the ground and kind of that's it. You know what I mean? Like the closest people get to the idea of a dead body is probably the next episode of CSI Miami. You know, I feel that like death in the short term is very, very kind of big. You know, the kind of the violent kind of removal of life is so there in our society. But yet what happens after that isn't really kind of like, you know, the years and years of decay and decomposition, but also of memory of the dead person. That's not really focused on. And I think that's something, you know, I would like to see more of an celebration of understanding in that sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. So both the physical, what you mean, I guess, is the physical and also, you know, the above ground memorialization and how those processes work at the great gravesides in the past and in recent societies. Yes. And I think, of course, there's so many sort of expectations on duration that we have, that people will be mourning for a while, but then they'll somehow get over it and move on. And a lot of the work, at least as far as I understand it, by other disciplines, is showing that in our society, Whether we see our society as aberrant in its relationship with the dead or pretty standard across time, I think we are quite aberrant in a series of ways. But one of the things that I think we still see is that bonds cannot be put, you can't put a nice, easy, predictable timescale on mourning and when people want to retain connections with the locations where disposal takes place. And I'm not sure necessarily that people will thank us for talking too much about decomposition all the time, but I think it is important, absolutely right, that needs to be flagged up. The body is not in a static state when it goes in the ground, and it's going to continue to change in a whole variety of ways. So I think the more understanding we can shed on that, on just how regularly in the past burials, disposal can take many different forms, when the more we can shed light and on the variety of responses to death, I think it can help break down this idea that there should be a formula for how we all should respond to death and how we should dispose of the dead. And I think the more we do that, the better, really. And I think archaeology does have a function in that regard, you know, of just flagging up the differences between societies, but also within our own, and that there is not, it's okay to chart your own, you know, complex route in navigating bereavement and navigating how you want to memorialize your loved ones. And archaeology is about the future in that regard, because we've got issues of cemetery space we've got to face, we've got issues of different disposal methods we've got to are available to us. And I think we archaeologists can bring a lot of debates in here and perspectives in here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Okay, we've got Jordan from The Art of Charm back with us. Jordan, what have you had on The Art of Charm podcast lately?
Actually, we had a lot of really interesting guests lately. I've had a bunch of entrepreneurs come on and talk about their mindsets and methodologies for getting ahead and kind of keeping the hustle going even when you don't feel like it. I had a guy come on and talk about self-defense, but not from like a how-to perspective, but more of the mindset of somebody who survives deadly attacks, which I thought was really interesting. And we had the founder of Pencils of Promise, which is a really large charity that builds schools in third world countries, come and talk about actually making your kind of your passion, for lack of a better word, happen in reality. He used to be a finance guy and he bounced and started this uber successful charity. So we talk about that process as well. And we've actually had some people come on and talk about networking. One of the guys that talked about it was a military special forces guy who was in Afghanistan. And he's talking about how he built relationships with people in the Taliban and things like that to save lives. So if he can do it, we can do it for business and academic purposes, of course.
Great. Yeah, I've heard a few of those already. And that Pencils for Promise one was incredibly inspiring. So what have you got coming up for the month of April?
I've actually got a bunch of really talented guests coming in. I've got Gretchen Rubin. She's going to come up real soon, where she's actually talking about happiness and how your brain works and how your brain measures happiness and things we can do day to day, actual habits to help make us quote unquote happier. I've got this guy, Nev Medora. He's a friend of mine, but he talks about crashing parties, not just for the sake of quote unquote crashing the party and getting into an exclusive event, but using that to sort of meet important people. And that's a really useful skill set. Even if you don't plan on crashing parties, he has some really good sort of life hacky ideas that go along with it. And I've got Simon Sinek coming on to talk about leadership. He actually helped develop the Zappos culture and is a business thought leader of the highest caliber. And last but not least, I have Olivia Fox Cabane, author of The Charisma Myth. She's actually going to be talking about the brain science involved in her new book that's coming out like a year from now, but we get a sneak peek at that as well. And that's all coming up in April.
Awesome. Well, be sure to check out the Art of Charm podcast wherever you find podcasts when the show is over. You can find them also at www.artofcharm.com.
Definitely.
I mean, do you think, for example, that people make a connection between the ancient graves that we excavate and the kind of remains that they intend to be? Do you think people keep it, just sort of play a game in their minds to keep those things apart?
I'm pretty sure there are a number of people who now want a Viking burial, you know, like the kind of pyre on the boat thing, you know, although like, I mean, that's cliche and it's probably not true, but
well, small dinghy then maybe or something. Yeah, okay, but no. So you say inspirations from the past is a really interesting area, and we've seen a few metal bands members doing that kind of thing, haven't we? And various other kinds of celebrities try to go down that route. But I think it does. It does. Whether it's something as radical as that, we do see subtle interventions of past practices coming back in, styles of gravestones and symbols.
No,
it's quite interesting.
I think what's also interesting about archaeology is the fact that. This is coming back to a really cool blog post you did on morbid curiosity, and it's something that I think is not really talked about inside of archaeology that much. You know, like, obviously there's a debate with, in terms of how archaeology deals with the public, and I sit on the cusp of saying, well, look, you know, the public should be allowed to hear the conversations we have about talking to the public. You know, like, this is why this podcast is kind of like, I talk to archaeologists as an archaeologist myself, and I'm hoping that what happens is people have a kind of like sitting on the train hearing two people who are interested about something have a debate, and you don't need to kind of do the, you know, normally if you have to, normally there are some things you have to maybe leave out, or you have to kind of like boil down or reduce, you know, so that everybody understands what's going on. But like, in the same way where you only know fragments of a language, but you can hear a conversation, you understand the interplay between the two people, you can get understanding of what's being said. Yeah. I think we should be much more out there when it comes to saying to people, well, this is what we're talking about. Are we making sense? Because
About the morbid curiosity issue, I mean, there's a number of things I was trying to rant about in that post. One of which is the whole issue of, you know, sort of using the straw man of, we can't just be morbidly curious in the dead. We have to be respectful. And I, one of the things I hate about this is this idea that, the ill-educated, the unknowing, the unspecialized person is morbidly curious, but the trained human osteologist or mortuary archaeologist is entitled to intervene into funerary realms. And while I would suggest that, you know, I'm not encouraging everyone to just go out and trash an ancient cemetery, I think the idea that the uneducated public are morbidly curious is a problematic one. And it's like if you heard two people talking about supernovas on the train, or galaxy clusters, or some astrophysics phenomenon, or cosmological phenomenon. You're like, oh, it's disgusting. Look at the way they have no understanding. They're just gawping at galaxies. They have no understanding of how they're made. They just talk about how pretty they look, and look at those spiral arms. You know, oh, so disgusting how they're ignorant of physics, and they don't even watch that Brian Cox guy on television. They have no, you immediately think, what a prat. You know, you don't. You want the aesthetics, the immediacy of space and time, and the big superficial things have to be of interest for people to then occasionally follow up with programs, follow up with reading, take courses, maybe even do a degree in astrophysics because they once watched the X-Files, you know. And the same with Time Team. You know, the same with the ancient dead. You know, we've got to have ways into archaeology, the fascination. And if morbid curiosity has to be one of those ways that people say, look, I don't look at these skeletons. What's that about? How did they become skeletons? Why are they buried with that object? Why are they buried in that grave? That is that instinctive, visual, tangible curiosity. Let's not be snobby about it and dismiss it as ill-educated. That's the way in. People are worried about their own deaths. People are worried about their family's deaths and their friends. They also know that archaeologists dig up lots of skeletons and they're in the local museum. Why do we have to be snobby about that and say, oh, no, we must rise above this morbid curiosity and we must, you know, enter into a much more sophisticated dialogue? Of course we must. But let's not deride anyone that hasn't got there yet or isn't thinking about the bigger debates of a master's student or postgraduate. Let's celebrate that interest in funerary remains. And the same, so what I say about X-Files into astrophysics, one could say the same with Time Team into archaeology. There may be things that drive us mad about these popularizations, but morbid curiosity should be something we celebrate, not something to be derided.
Do you know what I find really ironic is that archaeologists are the biggest purveyors of morbid curiosity. Like, let's just focus on the fact that basically anything to do with humans in the past, those humans are dead. Like that's the way they are. And whether it's 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 10,000 years, they're still dead. I think that like archaeologists have to be morbidly curious to be archaeologists. I mean, can you imagine an archaeologist who isn't interested in dead people?
Not many. Not many.
It doesn't work.
In our own lives, when it will be something that will be difficult to face, depending on our, you know, if you or I find ourselves in a position where, you know, it's just too close. I don't, you know, I've been writing about these, you know, Anglo-Saxon burials, or I've been writing about these Victorian cemeteries or these modern gardens of remembrance, but I just can't face this topic right now, and I'll have to leave it for a while. And but I think really you can't not be interested in it, because it affects so much of our data, whether it is skeletal material or it is more broadly Neolithic chamber tombs or whatever it might be. The dead are somewhere, either indirectly or directly.
But that's I think this also plays into a wider debate in archaeology about coming across as serious or not. You know what I mean? Like there does seem to be almost like a constant need or desire to be somber and to be stoic, and that's how people will take us seriously as archaeologists. When, in fact, we need to be ridiculous. We need to be, like, more ridiculous than we currently are. Because, ultimately, we build up this kind of, like, authority through this, like, strict way of, well, we're the archaeologists and we have the final say on this. Oh, we're definitely going to be serious about this. But ultimately, you know, people can't really relate to that. People can relate to horrible histories. Now, horrible histories is one of the best examples of the most truthful history out there, because what it does is it puts facts in a relational and translated kind of fashion. It refers back to the modern era, things that people know and recognize, and people unpack the pieces of the past that are wrapped up in modern ideas. But because and I think that we as archaeologists have to be not take ourselves so seriously. There is obviously the caveat of, you know, also being serious when it there's the necessity to be serious.
I'm very good at being ridiculous, so that's no problem for me. But I equally find
among friends here,
you know, one has to. It almost reminds me. I don't know if you remember the, you know, Chris Morris and the Day to Day and the Brass Eye, where he does that spoof newscaster where they do that sort of, I'm doing a sensitive voice now. You know, this kind of, we're talking about the dead. We've got to talk with seriousness. And it's painful. And it's painful because while we don't want to be constantly making light of subjects that do affect people, we can't be in a situation where we have to adopt a party line of style of writing, visualizing popular and academic articles about this topic. So, for example, I've pushed it out a couple of times. For example, an academic journal article I wrote a couple of years, I thought they'd never let this through peer review, but the very, very, very supportive interdisciplinary journal, which I've never had such a, well, I've had only a few very positive journal article experiences of such quality, was the Journal of Material Culture published an article I did on Ashes to Asses, talking about cremation and memorialization in a donkey sanctuary. And actually the charity, which is very highly regarded, could have taken this as a personal slight. They seemed very happy about it because I shared my article with them, and it's full of puns and painful puns, almost physically painfully about donkeys and ashes to ancestors and asinine ancestors and all these silly. And I thought this, Why can't I put this kind of humour slant on when the actual content of my research and the concepts I'm addressing have validity? Why can't it be done within a framework that has a bit of humour? Even if not everyone shares my sense of humour, why cannot that take place? And they were very supportive, and it went through with the puns in place. I've had puns removed by editors. I've had jokes removed by editors. But these, the Journal of Material Culture, God bless them, they kept them in. And I think that's the key point here. I'm not using humour to deride anyone living or dead. Humour is there to be taken or left, but it can be an effective device of communicating ideas to the public and to other scholars. So we should be very, very critical of this attempt to equate respect with a particular style of communication and a particular style of delivery, because it leads to very bland and very cautious and unexciting research. And I think we can not constantly, we don't want to shock people, but we do have to sometimes think about alternative ways of visualizing and writing about death in the past, I think.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because this is what I think the reason why, well, quote-unquote pseudo-archaeology has taken the front for a lot of things. For a lot of people, it's, you know, those kind of shows. We know what those kind of shows are. That kind of don't really... They ask a lot of questions, but they don't rely on a lot of data. That's what I'll leave it at. But they take the audience because they don't have reservations about being serious. Instead, they want to present something that's maybe a little bit out of left field. There may be a bit of humor, a little bit of jokes. There's ideas there that normal people can relate to easily, and there's not this serious authority, you know, and this way of communicating that's in a particular way that may be kind of bland and, you know, boring. And I think it's precisely, we've caused this ourselves, you know, as archaeologists, by, you know, trying to criticize anybody who does kind of go out the normal bounds. Because I know archaeologists can make great, terrible jokes. Like, seriously, I've yet to meet an archaeologist who doesn't make a good, like, who doesn't have like a few up their sleeve. Do you have a favorite, actually? Do you have a favorite joke?
No, not a standard. I can't think of any off the top of my head. I don't actually. I can't think of any.
There's a gentleman who does, like a stand-up comedian, but he's like kind of tied to archaeology a little bit. His name is Paul McGarrity, and he had this great one. Let's see what you think of this one. So, okay. Why are archaeological digs in Italy more expensive?
I don't know. Why are they?
Roman charges.
It's
great, isn't it? I love it.
I'm laughing inside and outside simultaneously. That's fantastic.
I thought, like, you know, it gets funnier every time I say it. I don't know why, because I can imagine all these people going, oh, for God's sake. I mean, that's like, this is the thing, is that, like, I think archaeologists are primarily, like, people who are a little bit nerdy or geeky. This is what I said before, like, people a little bit nerdy and geeky, and also they love terrible jokes. Like, I think it's one of those things. And it's sad that that's not really fully reflected in what we see of archaeologists, you know?
Well, I must say, I did. The Richard III funeral was a great laugh, because I was really enjoying that with all the tweeting, the alternative tweeting of various different critiques of Richard III that was going on online, including the parody Elton John song lyrics, which I, you know, is no disrespect to the University of Leicester and their archaeological team, which has done a fabulous job. But it's but still, one cannot help find it both laughable and painful at the same time. The theatre surrounding the funeral and the vested interests in it. Without, you know, I'm happen to be a great fan of Leicester's archaeology program and its colleagues, but I think we've got a bit more parody has got to take place. That was a particularly hilarious and painful moment. But equally, it was all good prominent TV advertising for Mortuary Archaeology and YouTube and elsewhere. So I'm not complaining. Obviously, I'm jealous that the king I was trying to dig up, we couldn't find his grave, and instead we found some Bronze Age kists instead. But, you know, I'm not too bitter. I'm very bitter, but I can live without it. I really don't want to find the last Plantagenet king. I'm glad someone else has, because I wasn't really much of a fan.
Oh, yeah. But this is the thing. You can make fun of something and still have respect for it. I think that, like, getting that balance right is difficult at times, but I think that, like, a lot of people are very reactionary, and they're happy to kind of take up arms and, like, grab the pitchfork as soon as possible without kind of stepping back and saying, actually, wait a minute, what's going on here? I mean, you know, this is the thing. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek.
I have now.
You have not. He's one of my favorite philosophers just for his style of talking. but he can seem a bit kind of like, he's a bit, it's easy to kind of listen to him. So he's not terribly highbrow in some cases, but he loves telling dirty jokes. And basically, if he doesn't know somebody, what he'll do is he'll get them, tell me the worst joke you know, like the most horrible joke you know, right? Or tell me like something that derides your own culture, right? Because he has this idea that basically once you tell a dirty joke to somebody and they tell you a dirty joke, you're friends. That's it. You're sorted. Because ultimately, you know, you have this understanding in humor. You know, you don't need to have this kind of like, oh, I don't know who you are. What, I don't want to offend you. Instead, you go full throttle, right? And everybody understands that it's ridiculous and it's not what you actually believe. Because I think a lot of people, it's almost like the first thing they say, you're like, ah, that's what they definitely must believe, you know? Rather than thinking, are they being sarcastic? I think that's one of those things that you have to, it's something we have to deal with, you know? Archaeology has to be more ridiculous and funnier, but, you know.
Well, I think equally, when we're in a culture where actors can say jokes about fictional characters and still be cause massive online offence, we're in a culture which has still struggles with reality and fiction and still struggles with even the distinction between the past and the present. So offending someone who's just died and or joking about someone who's just died is a very different thing from talking about a Bronze Age burial and making a quick quip about some kind of pun about ashes or bones or and I think that we do struggle with perspective in our society, because despite the depth of the virtual and physical engagement, the complexity of our communication systems, we still very happily revert to a one-dimensional view of any dialogue. And I think that that is the problem we face as archaeologists, because the more we try to be public intellectuals, that's a very pompous way of doing it, but that's an archaeological dialogue's discussion of late. They said about public intellectuals, how do we be a public intellectual? But public voice or public figure in any regard, the more we're going to just knock everyone off, and the more that our humour will be misread. And if we try to communicate across different nations in different languages, the more likelihood we will offend somebody. So I do a blog about the Vikings History Channel program, which I love to bits. I think it's fantastic. And immediately I'm followed by Viking-loving neo-Nazis online, you know, and I'm offending someone who really thought it was all reality, you know. So you find yourself, or if I make if I dare to call in my blog a fan of Richard III, a royal necrophiliac, then suddenly I'm getting angry. I'm getting angry emails about my misdiagnosis of Richard III's osteological conditions or pathological conditions. So, as if I care. So my point is that there's no attempt to work out what I'm talking about in the broader context. It's about homing in on individual sentences and not seeing the context. And I think the people that do love dead royals are royal necrophiliacs. They're fawning over dead bodies, isolated from their historical context, as if they're people they knew and loved. And I think that's deeply worrying. And I think archaeologists need to be very careful about getting into bed with those kind of characters. But that's no distraction from the quality archaeological work done on projects like that. So I'm happy to blog about that type of thing, as long as it's read in context. But of course it isn't going to be read in context. No. Someone's always going to take offense. So I think we've got to find strategies of saying things online without becoming archaeological Katie Hopkinses and not, or whatever her name is, but equally, yeah, that is her, isn't it? But the one person everyone hates. And basically, you know, we don't want to become in a situation like that where we're constantly saying inflammatory things. But we also have to critique things that we find problematic and address issues that we personally find an issue. But I can say that because I'm working in a university. But I can't say that if I'm working for a commercial unit. And I can't say that necessarily if I'm working for a museum. Because so I'm quite privileged in having that view. I don't know what you feel about that, but and whether as a student or as a junior career person maybe who doesn't feel they can speak out, there is a lot of fear about causing offence and the repercussions of that. But at least I feel reasonably confident I can say things and not cause problems. But I don't know. What do you think?
I must say that this is something I did. Like, I've had a lot of people kind of say to me, you know, it was actually only until after I graduated that I started learning about the world of archaeology. Because I started off as a chemist, right? And then more than halfway through my degree, I was like, nope, I'm changing to archaeology with chemistry. And so I had a lot of catch up to do, but I basically fell in love with archaeology halfway through my degree, and I couldn't live without it, so I had to do it. And after I graduated, people were saying, right, just, you know, keep it on the down low and just, you know, do a few digs and then just get into commercial archaeology, move it up from there. I was like, no, I'm doing a podcast, I'm broadcasting to the world, and you know, I'm not letting anything go, because ultimately I'd rather say what I want to say and engage with people and say something that might be like, might make other people feel, oh, well, I don't think I can hire him, he's going to go crazy, rather than just be silent and just be like, almost like conforming to the hegemony. I can't get that word right, but like,
no, I know what you're talking about, and everyone says it differently. Yeah.
And this is the thing, is like, because I don't want to be part of a culture, right, that promotes a status quo. I want to be challenging in a space where something constructive can happen. And I don't think something constructive can happen when there's an implicit rule to be silent, you know? Obviously, there are nuances to this. You know, you have to be ready to deal with clients who may not want information out there, but that's just something to work around, you know? I mean, there have only been two emails I've received back when I've sent out for, you know, people to talk to me on this show. Two emails have said, have refused. That's it. Out of, I'd say, almost over 100 emails sent out.
Oh, that's pretty good.
And a lot of the time it's because I try and chat to people beforehand and build up a little bit of an understanding. But the two emails were from commercial people tied to commercial companies. You know,
well, that may be telling, and I think that is a bigger problem that people. I'm not the first one to observe this. Is that there? You know, academics. I have the ability to say things that, you know, maybe they fear this will impact on me being hired. No, it's not going to necessarily impact on me being hired. But equally, we should have an opportunity, even with podcasts and even with tweets and so on. We should have the opportunity to, you know, say, well, I said that last year and now I don't quite adhere to that view. I mean, I can't imagine there's many contexts where an opinion, political or otherwise, is going to cause long-term effects. But mortuary issues can be perhaps some of those sensitive if you get a reputation of constantly saying a particular kind of thing. And I think it's important to change the record.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever we're talking about, whatever our campaign or our passion is, to make sure that we're changing the theme and we're not just repeating ourselves on the same thing. I think that may be more negative thing than
I don't think else. It's not maybe like exactly what you say, because archaeology, I've learnt, is very connected in some ways. Like, I think people are very connected, but archaeology as a whole seems to be kind of, there's little circles. And the thing is, once you get any sort of reputation, I feel sometimes what's been communicated to me is like, sometimes if you have a habit of saying something, you know, might get glossed over, you know, and somebody else will be taken in instead of you. But, like, at the same time, that doesn't stop me, because I'm ever so slightly Marxist, and I believe the revolution begins with yourself. And if you aren't ready to kind of make a stand for what you believe in, even if it is held against you, then that's not really very principled, you know? You obviously don't really stand for that at all. I mean, like, recently, I don't know if you were following the Charter Institute for Archaeologists conference recently in Cardiff, I think it was.
I certainly didn't attend. I've only been to one of them before they were chartered, so I wasn't following all what was going on.
One of the biggest things to happen out of that was the hashtag for Every Dig Sexism.
Oh, yes, I've been reading some of those,
and
yes.
That was absolutely shocking. Like, to me, that was shocking because I don't know what it's like at the university you work at, but at the University of Aberdeen, I was surrounded by many amazing women who were not only my dissertation advisor, my course advisor, they were like basically people who led me through trying to actually manage to get a degree at the end of swapping it, and who supported me and taught me a lot of stuff. And like, it's just so shocking to hear that there are still so many problems. I thought archaeology might be a bit different, but I guess that was a bit naive of me.
Well, I wasn't at the session. I didn't hear about that. I mean, I'd be interested, given you want to talk to me about the blog, the mortuary angle for that, because I wonder whether any of those tweets actually related to not what people say about live women, but what they say about dead women, because that would be really interesting to me. I didn't see any links to that, but it was very much about auto experience. You know, of my experience is someone made a quip about this, and you then have to reflect on whether some of those were just unquestionably offensive and derogatory and revealed much of that person's behaviour. Others, one could imagine, is that just a really bad day that someone said something really stupid, like just as we've been, I've been conceding myself that occasionally we say things that we may regret, but equally, you know, it's important to risk it rather than just to be totally neutral. But I would say that most of those are quite horrible to read, for what I did read. But I just wondered about whether any females or males have examples of every dig mortuary sexism, or I don't know what the equivalent would be, every death sexism or something, where you actually the differential treatment of the dead, memorials or human remains, in terms of the respect they're afforded or the narratives talked about them. Because there's a long tradition in mortuary archaeology of slapping interpretations on females who happen to have particular artifacts and males who have the same artifacts, but coming up to completely different narratives because of our predisposed modern gender assumptions. So that has been critiqued, but still, I wondered how often it comes up in digs and how often it comes up in surveys. Because I can tell you a lot of the joking is very age related about the dead people, that you won't find people talking about young children a lot. You know, that is the absolutely sacrosanct, but you will get jokes or comments about the names on memorials depending on the age and occupation or the of both men and women. But I don't know, that'd be an interesting theme I'd love to see more about, because I think not only the how we talk about ourselves as professionals or students, but as how we talk about our subject matter, the things we're digging up, can be as revealing of our prejudices as anything. Yeah.
And I think that's definitely something that we can make a little hashtag out of that. Exactly. Hashtag. But what I was going to say is that, like, I think for example, it was that the Red Lady of Palavan. Have I got that correct? That it's actually a young gentleman, and obviously, obviously, it was only after more careful analysis that was figured out. Because, of course, it's red powder and, women like makeup, guys. But I think there's a wider issue of just, a general kind of, like, definitely on an outside view, people see archaeology as very male. But that's definitely not what I've seen from where I've kind of learnt about archaeology. I've seen it actually as...
Yeah.
I think most of my class were women, actually. Now that I think about
it. I happen to work with in a small archaeology and history department, but I work with probably as many women as men in my department. But as it happens with the archaeologists, we've got four archaeology female archaeologists and two male archaeologists. No, three. So four female, two, three male. And but in terms of the students, it's a sort of a slight female bias as well. And so. We have to think about where is that translating to in terms of the people who go on, how they progress through, and I think many of the concerns are in that gap between undergraduate and lecturer position in the academic world of archaeology, of how does that translate through. I mean, I'm very concerned about some of the opinions, but I think it's not the words and what people said to people that really matter as much as what actually happens, because people can be as polite in their respectful language towards gender and age and ethnicity groups, but it's about how that actually plays through in practice that really matters. So frankly, if we have to live with inflammatory language or sexist language, then we have to live with it. But it's not really that that's the effective aspects of the status quo or change. It's the way people behave. And I've seen job interview situations where it's quite clear that various points that should not have been raised were raised because of the gender of the individual involved. I haven't seen that at my current institution, and I don't know if it's already at my previous institution, but I have seen it in other scenarios. And it's not always in favour of male men. It can work both ways, especially when you have specialisms where there's a tradition of one gender over another. So there are these strange subcultures we have in mortuary archaeology where most human osteologists are female, That aside, I'm just saying that I think it's about what actually happens in action, and rather than just occasional derogatory comments that we have to face. And I think that's much more important.
Mm-hmm. No, it's definitely something that merits wider discussion. I'm hoping actually to have a episode dedicated to everyday sexism. I'm just working out the best way to do that at the moment. I'm hoping to have something out pretty soon, because I think it's something that's definitely made waves, definitely in the archaeological blogosphere. I've seen a few people now typing about it and their own kind of experiences and stuff. I'm hoping that we definitely are able to dig and excavate something more about it, you know, because after all, we should hold ourselves to a higher standard. I mean, we're technically anthropologists, technically. And, you know, we should understand what we do, you know? But, like, I think some people are just oblivious to the culture of archaeologists. And I think there is sometimes a little bit of a culture there, you know? Whether it's a subculture and just a way of doing certain things, I do think there's something that's overlooked occasionally. You know, just the way archaeologists are. But I would like to finish on something a little bit lighter. I'm a big metalhead, and I love the fact that death is a big part of metal, and like the kind of like imagery there. I mean, do you listen to much heavy music, or do you prefer lighter music like other archaeologists?
Frank Sinatra. No. What do you need? In terms of my musical. I have massive holes in my musical knowledge. In terms of heaviness of music, if you want to call it, yeah, I like some prog metal. I'm a great Dream Theater fan. Great Dream Theater fan. That's probably not heavy metal for you, but it's technical, fast, and all varied. And I love their stuff. And they're one band that actually don't obsess too much about death. But in terms of the morbid size of death metal, I can't comment on too much, but I do like some heavy music, and I use it to compose and write to, and to keep out the noise of screaming students in my soundproof cellar, which obviously I have beneath my massive mansion in the countryside. Don't take me seriously, please. There's somebody out there worrying now.
It's funny.
Iron Maiden, of course. Who doesn't like Iron Maiden?
Of course. Well, you know, it's really funny. Iron Maiden was only a recent discovery for me. I took a nosedive in terms of heaviness, and about a couple of years ago, I hit a wall where I couldn't listen to anything heavier because there was nothing heavier. Like, I got to the wall of you can't make this sound any heavier, so I had to start walking backwards. So it was.
Has to happen to all of us. I mean, but it's even Iron Maiden's a good example for Gats, because one of the albums that I never liked as a kid, listening to Iron Maiden, I loved all the early albums. I gave up about Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, and I haven't really listened to any post 1987 Iron Maiden. I'm talking about early Iron Maiden, but I couldn't get into Pieces of Mind. And then when Rush guitarist Alex Lifeson said recently, or I read recently, probably said it a decade ago, but Pieces of Mind, one of the most influential albums on Rush's early 80s sound, I thought, oh, is it? I'll have a listen to that again. And it just blew me away. And I thought, why couldn't I get into this album before? And it's amazing how you just, you know, little gaps in your experience. But Pieces of Mind, ridiculous songs. Love them. Absolutely love them. Die With Your Boots On, is that one of them? For that? Anyway, it doesn't matter. But it's lovely stuff. A great gross album cover, as you can imagine from the title.
Definitely. Yeah. I just think there aren't enough archaeological death metal groups out there, you know. I had some, obviously some of my own suggestions. I have to...
Give me some suggestions.
Obviously, like, I was writing a song called, Postmortem Fetal Expulsion. It's another term for coffin birth. There is, of course, post-depositional chemical alteration.
And all of these well in choruses, I feel, in sort of more harmonic Linkin Park style, I can imagine.
Actually, one of my favourite albums is Carcass's Necroticism, Descanting the Insalubrious. Basically, it's an album where they took a medical textbook and they just looked up all the terms that sounded the most brutal. And I feel you can do that with archaeology as well. You know, like, there are some really brutal terms in archaeology. And I'd like to kind of have something that sounds like similar, because they have these like little sound clips at the start of every song. So it's like, bodies come into this department in pieces or decomposed, and we try and build a picture of the body. Yes, the upper body was very badly damaged post-mortem. I love it. It's just so cool. Because I can just imagine, like, you know, an archaeologist saying, well, the back of the skull was very badly damaged in a person's lifetime, but as you can see, there were bones thus healed back. The person was in incredible pain for several months after the injury. Just...
You see, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. We need to flip it back the other way. We need to not worry about how we can create death metal bands as archaeologists. We really need to think about how death metal and perhaps other kinds of metal and perhaps also rap wars need to be coming more prominently into archaeological conference.
Oh my God, yes, yes. The epic rap battles of history. Do you know them?
Yeah. Oh, but I can imagine. I've seen some. Yes, I have.
Okay, so the complete side option. Epic rap battles of history. The one about Stalin... Right, and Russian history in the 20th century is like perfect. It is great. But I would put Lewis Binford versus Shanks and Tilly. Like that or no, we start off with Gordon Child versus Binford. And it's like an argument against, you know, like new archaeology and culture history. And then it's like Shanks and Tilly just come in like completely just like, you know, destroy Binford, and then suddenly from the heavens descending on high is Hodder, like on a wave of like clouds, and be like, yeah, interpretive archaeology.
Do you realize I'm traumatized by this image now? Okay, no, sorry. I love you. Yes. Record. you have equally, you can mix and match. So you can have Shanks and Tilly versus Millie Vanilli. You know, you can why have like, you know, various different. No, never mind. Let's not go. But you know, you could. I think one of the best ones would be something like a Renfrew versus anyone, really, or everyone. Like, you know, that scene at the beginning of Kung Fu Panda where he's fantasizing about fighting the tenth demons on demon. And I can imagine till Renfrew there, sort of facing off the tide of illicit trade of antiquities, you know, and every post-processualist in this horde of angry masses, and him there doing his martial arts. I think that's an image to take away from this podcast.
Oh, it
really
definitely is. I you know what? Actually, I've got a session at the EAA in September. And I'm hoping to kind of open it by saying, right, guys, if you don't like post-processualism, you're not welcome here. Get out. Just leave by the door, please. And I'll see how many people take me seriously. I want to really kind of either that, or I'll wrap the intro to the entire like session. I don't know if that's done at conferences. I want to be like the first.
I think the problem is with the EAA, you may have lots of multilingual people who do generally misinterpret you and do leave the room. In fact, I could do it for you. I mean, I'll see you at the EAA and I'll just go, I'm not standing for this, and I'll walk out.
Oh, that's
if you like.
Wonderful.
It'll add a bit of dynamism to the whole thing. And I was actually going to the loo, but I'll make it sound like I'm objecting to something.
Oh, yeah.
And you know,
I've already said I'm bringing cake to the session, so it's called It Belongs on the Internet, and it's basically about I'm interested kind of being the first session that I've ever taken. I want to make it special, so I wanted to do something that nobody else has done. Never mind who kind of like what anybody thinks of it. I'll thinking of like randomly just spouting out some German, because I know how to speak German, and that'll probably cover half my audience, hopefully. But you know,
You'll be surprised. Nothing can go wrong at conferences. It's a naive idea to think that there is any mistake that could possibly happen. There's no looper that, you know, whatever you do, it's the right decision, I'm sure. And it'll be a great event. I'll be there somewhere anyway at the EAA. I hope to be there. I'm one of my other roles, I'm editor of the Archaeological Journal, and they want to have some meet the editor sessions, so people who want to potentially publish in the journal. And since we cover the whole of these islands and we cover all periods, so it's a good venue. So I'm going to be hopefully pestering people for mortuary or other dimensions. I'm getting a lot of Anglo-Saxon cemeteries submitted at the moment. That's great, but I'd like some other stuff, please.
Definitely, definitely. And if people want to find your blog and read what you have to say, where can they find it?
Just Google the word Archaeo Death, which sounds like some death metal band, yeah. Actually, doesn't it? And people have accused me of that. It probably is a death metal band, but if it isn't, maybe definitely. We should start one. But yeah, Archaeo Death, or just Howard Williams' blog, and it should take you to the WordPress. It's on WordPress.
That's absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for sitting down and having this amazing chat with me. We will definitely have to do something in the future. I'll probably have, like, you know, a side kind of set. Session at the EAA, yep. Probably do a podcasting live session. So,
podcasting live. That fast to the audience gathered. Yes, yeah, that's fantastic.
And so I'll have to give you, like, I'm wanting to kind of introduce everybody with a funny nickname. So we're going to see what we can do.
Yep.
I'll see if I can. You'll have to wear corpse paint.
Will I?
Okay. Yes.
I'll put in soundtrack as well. I've got one now. I just have brought it.
Actually, you know, I'm actually going to do an episode on black metal, because obviously a lot of problem with black metal is, like, a lot of it's nationalist and they use the wrong history of the Vikings to try and boost up their own identities and stuff. Yeah. And I've got a few people I want to talk about. Because the problem is, I like some of the music, but I don't like the people who play it, you know? So I get it through other means.
It's like people use Michael Jackson until they realize what an egotist weirdo he was.
No, it's not like Michael. Okay. Kind of like Michael Jackson. And you're on Twitter as well?
Sadly so, yes.
Do you tweet a lot? Are you Twitty mad?
I get bored, but no, I do tweet a lot. I do read Twitter more than I write on Twitter, which is something some people don't do. I tweet about the journal. I tweet about my blog. I tweet just random comments. But I don't love the medium, but it's I'm trying to love it.
It's okay. We'll convert you yet.
Okay.
Anyway, if you're interested in listening to more of this kind of stuff, check out the Archaeology Podcast Network. We have an amazing selection for shows for you to listen to. We have the CRM Archaeology Podcast. We have got Archaeological Fantasies, which deals with debunking pseudo-archaeology, or so they say. We have CRM Profiles, talking to actual archaeologists, would you believe? And of course, we have from the University of Sheffield, Archaeology in Ale, which is a monthly lecture series. So if you want that and much, much more, head on over to www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Thank you again to my guest, Professor Williams. We'll hopefully have you back sometime. In the meantime, you know, do whatever you do with Archaeo Death.
Thank you very much, sir. I will keep on Archaeo Deathing.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.